ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
They prayed, they preached, they rebelled. From God Forbid, this is the Religious Rebels podcast. The stories of people who defied empires and sometimes paid with their lives. From Joan of Arc's battlefield visions to Malcolm X's final revelation, we tell the stories of those who defied faith and remade it. Religious Rebels, the original disruptors. Search for God Forbid ABC wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
Hey, if you're in Naarm, Melbourne this week, I would so love you to join me, Natasha Mitchell, for a live conversation at the Fitzroy Town Hall. My special guest, Astrid Jorgensen, you might know her name as the woman behind Pub Choir, which gets these big crowds of strangers together around the country, around the world, to sing to their heart's content. But her own story is a big and lovely one too. Head to the Big Ideas homepage and look for Be In Our Audience down the bottom for details of how to get along. And on Big Ideas today, well, Australia's relationship with China, it's as vital as it is precarious. China is our major trade partner, but it's also seen as a security threat in the Asia Pacific. And to navigate that duality and to really understand China, you need to dive into the country's extraordinary past. So four savvy China insiders today on the show. Welcome. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Yes, the special event I'm bringing you today, China, Past, Present, Future, was recorded live at the 2025 Sydney Writers' Festival. Peter Harcher, the political and international editor of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, is joined by Linda Javen, cultural commentator, translator, writer and author of Bombard the Headquarters, China's Cultural Revolution. Associate Professor Louisa Lim at the University of Melbourne is an award-winning journalist who reported from China for a decade for NPR and the BBC. Her latest book is Indelible City, Dispossession and Defiance in Hong Kong. And Edward Wong is an American journalist and diplomatic correspondent with the New York Times. He's author of At the Edge of Empire, A Family's Reckoning with China. An important thread through China's history is resistance and how its governments have dealt with the different waves of citizen uprisings against oppression. So let's start with Linda Javen as we dive with her into Mao's oppressive Cultural Revolution.
So in the Cultural Revolution, some of you may know, Mao started this thing to purge the party of his enemies, to reinvigorate a revolution he thought had gone stale. He did it for a number of reasons. It became an increasingly violent movement, which he basically did very little to temper, and the violence just kept spiraling. At one point in, I think it was 1968, it was just getting so crazy. And these students, Red Guard groups, were battling each other on Tsinghua University campus. And there were bodies. It was hideous. There were so many casualties. They were using tanks that they had made in the engineering department because it was such a good engineering school. But they also had grenades and they had poison gas and they had all this other stuff. So anyway, Mao finally got sick of it, and he sent in the Beijing Garrison Command and a huge delegation of workers from the city's factories to quell the riot or the battle. And what he did was, around the same time, the Pakistani foreign minister was visiting and gave Mao this basket of, and I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Sindri mangoes, which are supposed to be like the best. Anyway, this beautiful basket of mangoes, they were unknown in China as a normal food. Now, Mao presented those mangoes to the workers who had, you know, led this group in to quell the students. And this became this venerated thing. The mangoes represented Mao's love for the workers. It represented Mao's love for the people. The workers themselves who received the mangoes wouldn't eat them. They passed them from hand to hand, and they preserved them in formaldehyde and put them in vitrines. And then other like replica mangoes were created and put in vitrines. And the whole country was like passing around these replica mangoes and admiring them and worshiping them. And there was this thing where everybody would suddenly have mango-themed quilt covers or basins for washing your hands and face with mangoes. Mangoes. Everything was mangoes. So it became this amazing, weird mini cult within a movement that had many cults.
And I think, Louisa, you might have a mango anecdote in you.
I do. It's a really sad story.
Oh.
But when I got an advance for my book, I wanted to get something special, and I had become very obsessed with the mangoes, and I had gone down this mango, Mao mango wormhole where you find out that there's not just... they had wax mangoes that they gave to the propaganda troops, but they had plastic mangoes and glass mangoes as well. And they do come up for sale now and again, but they're extremely rare. The price of your mango depends on its quality. And the wax mangoes are most prized, and most prized is a flawless wax mango. So I thought I would use my a little part of my book advance, well, quite a large part, as it turns out, and buy a mango. And so I asked my friend who works at an auction house, how do you price mangoes? And she said, you cannot put a price on a wax mango. It literally cannot be priced because they're so weird and so rare. And I said, should I buy it? She said, well, it will probably accrue in value if you keep it well. So I bought a wax mango. They sent it to England. I carried it carefully in my hand luggage back to Melbourne. This is bad. I put it in its little glass vitrine. It was sitting on a little stand. Of course, what I forgot to take into account, it had come from Texas. I thought the climate there was quite hot. But on a summer day in Melbourne, the glass vitrine is like a magnifying glass. One day I came home and my poor little mango was just slightly puckered, a little bit shrunk. So then I had to buy a wine fridge to store my mango in. So I'm really sorry to my children. There's no university fund. We didn't go on any holidays, but we do have a wine fridge that is storing a slightly puckered wax mango.
It's a very exotic souvenir.
Well, that's how you know that you are truly a China tragic.
All three of your books, a theme that runs through all of them, is how the Chinese people have maneuvered around power, used power, resisted power, strong theme of resistance. Louisa, you took us back in the history of Hong Kong to a time before the birth of Christ where, you know, you tell us about the two competing narratives for Hong Kong's history, the British imperial narrative, which is there was nothing there when we turned up, there was just a barren rock, and then the actual Chinese history, which installs Hong Kong as an early base of resistance, which is fascinating, and I thought you might like to just give us an insight into that.
These two narratives, so China's narrative on Hong Kong is that it has been a part of China from time immemorial. And of course, Britain's narrative is completely different. And what I have tried to do is look at for the third narrative, the Hong Konger narrative, and that is harder to find because obviously neither Britain nor China are keen to propagate that narrative. But really, interestingly, because the history of Hong Kong is really bound up in the history of salt farming. So back 200 BC, the Nanyue Emperor instituted a salt monopoly, and it still continues today. This is the longest running monopoly in the world. China even have salt police. And that salt monopoly meant that salt production was centralized, and parts of Hong Kong became these massive salt farms policed with officials from the center. And one of the stories is that around 400 AD, a Chinese official called Lu Xun and 100,000 troops, they tried to fight against the central authorities. They were beaten back and back and back and back, and they ended up in Hong Kong in an outlying island called Lantau, living in caves in Tai O, which became this salt a place where salt was illegally farmed. And then when you get to the 11th and 12th centuries, there were a couple of uprisings of illegal salt farmers in Hong Kong and in Tai O. They're actually in the records that were put down by the central authorities. So, you know, I found this so interesting because it, you know, it's a different kind of creation myth about Hong Kongers, and it places Hong Kongers in this sort of lineage of rebels, you know, born from this insurrection on the outskirts, resisting central authority. And so that's the third lesser told story of Hong Kong's history.
And it puts the most recent years of protest and resistance into a whole new category, into a whole new light, because Hong Kongers were supposed to be just people who cared about making money and nothing else. And it turns out they have a history as well as a present of resistance.
That was the narrative. The narrative that both the British and the Chinese like to propagate, that Hong Kongers only care about making money and working. And I don't think it was ever true. You know, even from the days of early British colonization, there were all kinds of strikes and all kinds of opposition. So that narrative, obviously, when we came to 2014 with the Umbrella Movement and 2019, it really showed us how untrue that narrative is. You know, by the time we got to 2019, 2 million people marching in Hong Kong streets. That's about the same number of people that marched it during the People Power Movement in the Philippines, but it's, you know, almost a quarter of the population. And anyone who was there, I think you were there as well, Ed, at that time, you know, that sense of numbers was really quite extraordinary to be in a crowd that large.
On the same theme of resistance and empire, Edward, you've reported from Iraq on the Iraq War, as well as reporting for a decade or more from China as a correspondent. And you wrote, this phrase caught my eye, clarity to the nature of each imperium. You get clarity to the nature of each imperium in the use of power far from the center, in how these empires use their power far from the center. Can you tell us what clarity did it bring to you seeing the operation of US power in Iraq and Chinese power in one of the remote, is it perhaps the most remote region of China, Xinjiang province?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question, Peter. And Xinjiang, the region of Xinjiang, which is where some of you might have seen headlines in recent years about the repression of Uyghur Muslims out there and Kazakh Muslims, that's the heartland of the Uyghur Muslims and the Kazakh Muslims. It's a vast region that makes up 1/6 of the territory of China. There's deserts, mountain valleys, alpine forests there. My father, one of the core narratives of my book is that my father was posted out to Xinjiang as part of the initial military occupation of Xinjiang under Mao in the 1950s. So early on in my life, in my 20s, I started becoming very interested in Xinjiang and in the frontier regions of China, including Tibet. And I made journeys out there when I was a graduate student and then later as a correspondent. And before I moved to China as a correspondent, I worked for 3.5 years in Iraq. And so in Iraq, what I saw was obviously the exercise of American hard power, not soft power, but hard power, and the hardest power there is, which is essentially a conventional war and a military occupation. And then in Xinjiang, I also saw a much later day version of what my father had done, which was essentially some form of coercive control of the region by security forces, internal security forces at this point, and paramilitary units. I was there when there were ethnic riots that took place in 2009, and then the Chinese authorities sent in paramilitary units into the regional capital, Urumqi, and other cities. I was also there to see, you know, their efforts at changing the culture of the area by putting in very restrictive policies on the practice of Islam in the region and on the use of the language in schools, which is also an issue in the Tibetan areas. And so in both areas, I felt that the empires, the metropoles, Washington, Beijing, needed to use very coercive measures in order to keep control of it, and that they talked about, you know, winning the hearts and minds of the population, but in the end, they felt they had to rely on hard security measures. And I feel like if you look at the history of empires, essentially, it very much comes down to that. There are very few empires, I think, in modern history that have not relied on their military or internal security forces as you get farther out from the metropole. But then that's in a concrete sense. I think there's an abstract sense to the similarities I saw, which was that in my eyes, both the modern Chinese empire under Communist Party and the American empire, both young empires, have a sense of innocence about them. And the people who carry out their work have a sense of innocence about them, which is that they, when they're deployed to these places, they believe that they are doing good for the people there, that they are almost on, you know, a messianic role, and that they're there to deliver services to the people, they're there to improve the standard of living, they're there to improve the economy. I know the American soldiers I interacted with in Iraq felt that way about what they were doing in Iraq. The Chinese soldiers, police officers, officials out in Xinjiang, in Tibet, feel that way about what they're doing out there too. And my father felt that way when he was posted out to Xinjiang in the 1950s.
Wow. History might well judge that the Iraq War was one of the death throes of the American empire. I wonder how history will judge the Xinjiang repression. So we're going to go from the edge of empire, which is the name of Edward's book, to the center, Linda, with your book, which is called, the title of the book is Bombard the Headquarters. Now, the crazy thing about that title is that the guy calling for the bombarding of the headquarters was, in fact, the headquarters himself, Mao Zedong. How do you explain this madness to us?
Well, in 1966, Mao was feeling somewhat paranoid. He was feeling angry with the other people in the leadership. He felt that he had sacrificed. He was the only one left who had been a founder of the party in 1921. It was 1966 now. His ideas, including that the revolution should be based with the peasantry and that the people of China were its greatest resource, and if they used their collective will, they wouldn't have to go through the standard sort of Marxist process of you go through these different stages before you can achieve communism. So he'd said, we can just leap forward to communism. That was in 1958. And he insisted on complete collectivization of the economy. He insisted that it was possible to quadruple industrial and agricultural output by, for example, where you could productively plant one plant, you would have to plant four. So, of course, there were incredible failures of harvests. The industrial sector pretty much collapsed. Other factors played into that. But the result was, within 3 years, a mass famine in which tens of millions of people died. I've seen various figures up to 70 million. You can say 40 million is a pretty safe estimate. Now, the other people in the party, they couldn't quite push him away, but they sort of sidelined him to institute policies of, you know, allowing farmers to produce so much, give it to the state, and then use some to feed themselves or sell them on the markets. Mao was furious. He was like, this is taking the capitalist road. And he felt that Deng Xiaoping and President Liu Shaoqi, these people were leading a movement against him. They were creating an alternative headquarters. He believed that if a revolution was not continuous, even though the communists had power, there would be the rise of exploiting classes afresh. You would end up with a bureaucratized and corrupt revolution, as he saw Khrushchev had done after Stalin's death. He felt that was a revisionist regime. He was angrier and angrier, and he felt betrayed. He felt that he was surrounded by saboteurs, foot draggers, insubordinates, and that they were trying to create this other headquarters. So they're in this meeting, a five-day meeting. It's August 1966, and he's just boiling. He's sitting at one point, he's sitting next to the president, Liu Shaoqi, and he starts screaming at him. He was yelling at him, like right next to him. And I think everybody was pretty frozen. Mao, at this point, on the fifth day, takes a Beijing daily and scribbles in the margin of it with a pencil, bombard the headquarters. And he writes a few notes, gives it to his secretary. Secretary tidies it up, gives it back to Mao. Mao fixes it up again. Little teeny thing, it's not very big. He calls it my big character poster, which is a form of protest, a form of public expression. It's usually written with a brush and ink, and it wasn't. It was written with pencil in the margins of a newspaper, but it was distributed to the party, I'm sure absolutely terrifying everybody there, and distributed to the public. And it essentially incited party members, his supporters in the party, and the general public to attack those in the party who seem to be forming an opposition to him, the only true and, you know, worthy headquarters. And that wasn't the start of the Cultural Revolution. That came technically in May with a declaration by the party, but to my mind, that was a turning point. It was the part where the gloves came off. Following that, the Red Guards had already formed, but following that, there was such violence in Beijing alone that something like 2,000 people lost their lives and the crematoriums couldn't keep up with the load of bodies.
The insanity, I mean, I've read many accounts of the Cultural Revolution, personal as well as historical, but I don't think I'd ever read before, till I read it in your book, forgive me, maybe this is common knowledge, but it was so frenzied and over the top that they dug up the remains of former emperors.
Yes, and even an emperor's cat.
And beat up their skeletons.
Yeah, they did. There was a struggle session against the Emperor Wanli, who was dug up in the Ming Dynasty tombs. Yeah, I mean, the madness is almost impossible to comprehend.
Really?
And there was resistance, but you think, wow, those people are braver than almost any. I mean, the punishments, the retribution that you would receive for resisting was incredible. And yeah.
And the legacy of China's Cultural Revolution certainly lives large to this day. In China, as Linda Javen explores in her book Bombard the Headquarters, China's Cultural Revolution, on this panel, hosted by journalist Peter Harcher, are also New York Times journalist Edward Wong and former China foreign correspondent with NPR and the BBC, now host of the Little Red podcast, Louisa Lim. Natasha Mitchell bringing you this discussion on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas and the ABC Listen app, recorded live at the 2025 Sydney Writers' Festival.
Edward, I want to go back to you mentioned the theme of your book where you retrace your father's steps. One of those steps was in Tiananmen Square, and your father was there in 1950, the first year, celebrating the first year of the People's Republic, to see Mao at a military parade, and you returned to see another military parade in Tiananmen Square, I think 2015.
Yeah, 2015, and then again a second one in 2019 as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
And there in Mao's place is Xi Jinping. And Xi Jinping rallies the troops with the ritual cry of hardship, comrades, hardship, comrades. At what point does modern China get to relax after building a successful, you know, rich country, powerful army, the traditional mantra of the ideal? How much more hardship is there? When do they get to relax?
Well, it's a good question. Right now, as you know, they're about to enter they're entering this terror war of the U.S., so the hardship is on its way again. But I think your question gets to, a very fundamental idea within the party and within Xi, which is that you have to be constantly on the lookout for enemies within and enemies without. And in a sense, that's what gives the party its strength, and it's what gives the leader at the top of the party its strength. I think it was true in Mao's day. It's been consistent throughout. There's been moments when I think leaders relaxed on that idea a bit, but Xi has obviously re-embraced it with vigor. And I think one thing that I discovered when I was reporting on my book or researching it was how strongly Xi has been obsessed with the breakup of the Soviet Union. And I think this speaks to this idea that you have to maintain constant vigilance within the party. When he took power in 2012, but in 2011, he had a series of meetings with then Vice President Joe Biden. And I reported on these meetings when Biden came to China, and then when Xi went to the U.S. When Biden came to China, the two of them went out to Southwest China and visited what was a recovering earthquake zone. And then the two had dinner in a restaurant in a hotel in the city of Chengdu. And at the time, we reporters weren't privy to what was said at the dinner. But when I was researching my book on that episode, an American official was present at the dinner and was a China expert, one of Biden's China experts, said that at that dinner, the thing that was most notable was Xi talking about the breakup of the Soviet Union, and that he would tell Biden, he lamented the breakup to Biden. He said that it should never have happened, and that the Soviets had become weak, and that in China that he would never allow that to happen. And then he says the same message in a secret speech to party members. Very soon after taking power, he makes a trip to Guangdong province and gives a secret speech to party members where he says the same thing. And in that speech, he says no one was man enough in the Soviet Union to prevent that. And I think that that speaks, I think, to Xi's idea that China, this conception's territorial conception of China is very fragile, and that you have to be constantly on the lookout for whatever forces are acting within it and outside of it that could cause a breakup. And he uses this phrase called historical nihilism, which I'm sure Linda knows very well. Similar to what you were just saying about
Mao. I'm a historical nihilist.
Right, yeah. And so he says, she is obsessed with he's obsessed with talking about history. And so he says that one of the things that had weakened the Chinese party before he took power was this growing sense of historical nihilism in the party, where they were rejecting many of the original tenets of Mao. And so the party needed to return to this original sense of mission and of history, and that involves things like reinvigorating the rhetoric of Marxist-Leninism within the party, even if they don't really adopt the policies of, you know, they're not, I don't see Xi as like a full-hearted Marxist. His policies don't reflect that, but the rhetoric is important because it puts this surface-level ideology in the party, and it's the spine of the party, and he feels that you need to return to that in order to maintain control and power. That's all part of this idea of like facing hardship and needing to be wedded to hardship in order to make sure the country and the party run and stay in power.
Another point of continuity, Xi Jinping has resurrected some of the personality cult that Mao took beyond the point of utility to the point where Mao actually decided it had gone too far and had to wind it up himself. How strong is the resemblance of the Xi Jinping personality cult, Linda, to the Mao personality cult?
Well, Mao had a personality.
He had an advantage to start with. So this is a good point. How do you have a personality cult without a personality? What is it based on in Xi Jinping's case? Is it love? Is it hate? Or is it just based on shifting sands that will lead to nothing?
Well, he'd like it to be based on, you know, love and loyalty and all of that. And I think where it actually exists, it's very much a fantasy, I think, of the propaganda department. But people are loyal to him through nationalism, through the sense that, as he said, under Mao, China stood up. Under Deng, it got rich. In Chinese, all this kind of rhymes. It's like, 站起来, 富起来, you know, 强起来. And under him, it got strong. It gets strong. And there's a pride in that, and there's a constant effort to inculcate a gratitude towards Xi, you know. Mm. But, I mean, if you're going to compare, I would compare Mao with Trump.
Okay, are we going there, Linda?
We're going to come back to Donald Trump in a little bit. Louise, in your book, we meet you, the author in the book, we first meet you when you have a paintbrush in hand and you're drawing giant characters on a huge protest poster in Hong Kong, I think many meters high, including some profanities. And this is how you first bob up in the book, which is an arresting beginning. But it also, then you introduce us to the history in Hong Kong of the poster and the word, the written word, and its power in resistance. This brings us to maybe the central character in your book, which is the King of Kowloon.
Possibly another mad emperor type.
There you go. We're still on the theme of royalty. So tell us about this King of Kowloon. Who was he? What did he do? And why is he important today?
So I became very obsessed with the King of Kowloon because to me, he was just such an interesting symbol. He was a trash collector who had a disability after trash cans fell on his knee. So he was on crutches and he had an accident and was knocked out. And when he came to, he claimed that the whole peninsula of Kowloon had been stolen from his family in the 1860s when it was ceded in perpetuity to the British, and that he was the King of Kowloon. And then he spent 50 years writing on the walls and the streets of Hong Kong and Kowloon and the New Territories, and he would write these great big screeds 23 generations of his family trees, and the King of Kowloon, always in big letters. And you know, the extraordinary thing to me about the King of Kowloon was, you know, his words were washed away. Every day they would be washed out by government cleaners or painted over. But he kept going back and writing these very ugly, very poor, in very bad calligraphy, but very distinctive words on the walls. And he became Hong Kong's most valuable artist. He represented Hong Kong at the Venice Biennale. He became this sort of cult figure. Pop stars were wearing T-shirts with his writing on it. You could buy duvet covers and, you know, whiskey bottles, commemorative sneakers. And when he died in 2007, pretty much every newspaper in Hong Kong had sort of commemorative front pages saying, "The king is dead, long live the king," using special language in Chinese that you only use when a king dies. And so for me, I love this idea of someone declaring their own sovereignty and being accepted as the king, even if he actually had no power, even if the land had not originally been his. The fact that his work touched people to the extent that it became this commercial phenomenon, and you know, Hong Kongers do show what they like with money. And he created this reality around him. So for me, I love the metaphor of the King of Kowloon, but also I think he's an important character because he was the first person who really started this very public conversation about sovereignty and dispossession and land and territory. And you know, in the beginning, people thought he was mad and they would cross the road to get away from him. You know, there were people in the newspapers calling him psychotic. But after 2019, after the protests, a lot of people started thinking about him in a different way and saying, you know, in a way, you know, it was like a shaman, a prophet. So I tried to go back and look at his story and talk to people who knew him and who worked with him. And obviously it was a fool's errand, but it led me to some really interesting people because almost everybody who is important in Hong Kong's intellectual sphere, you know, the academics, the poets, the singers, the rap stars, the graffiti people, they'd all interacted or worked with the king. And after 2019 and the protests, a lot of these people were people who ended up being quite prominent in the protests. And so I felt like the king had kind of breadcrumbed my trail to take me to some of these people who I would never have found otherwise.
And does any of his influence still live on after this very draconian crackdown that we've seen in Hong Kong?
Well, you know, he made 55,000 works of art, and there were only about five left in public space, but they are being preserved now. And actually his work is still shown in the Hong Kong Art Museum because he's now being badged as anti-colonial.
He's been rebranded.
He's being rebranded. And in a way that was sort of the genius of the King of Kowloon, that because he only expressed himself in this way, you could use his words in whatever way that you liked. But I think that, you know, his influence does live on. I think that kind of disregard for authority, that rebelliousness, that mischievousness, you know, you see all of these were the things we saw over and over again in the protests, as well as, you know, huge posters and calligraphy and, you know, different ways of protesting that were quite innovative. So for me, the king was really the first person who did that.
And you tell us in the book that there's even a wall which is apparently blank to all intents and purposes, but after rain, in a certain light, the blank wall reveals the king's last words, I suppose. So both of you, Edward, Louisa, you've both written about protesters in Hong Kong, but in China as well, and the struggle for civilization, as you put it, against communism, the struggle for democracy against autocracy is in the hearts of many of the protesters. But now that we have Donald Trump in the White House, my question is, who is modelling, who is the champion of democracy and civilization in the world now? Who do we look to? I mean, Where do Hong Kong protesters look for hope? What's happened to the world?
Isn't the obvious answer Australia? Australia.
And Canada.
Well, yeah.
Well, it's the popular answer. We're very self-deprecating people, Edward. We always love to talk ourselves down, and we're very humble, so we would never say that, but thank you. Go on.
I mean, I think, so, you know, it's interesting because I'm sure Louisa saw this too, when in the 2019 protests, one of the things that struck me, I was there in October and November that fall, was that they had started to use many American symbols within the movement, because within the U.S. and Washington, this was during the first Trump administration, there was a bill that was going through Congress that would try and get the executive branch to impose sanctions on Hong Kong officials. I think the hope of the Hong Kong protesters is that if that bill passed, then it would exert coercive measures on Hong Kong officials and get them to back off their efforts to limit the protests, and then they would, and to give the protesters what they wanted. But, you know, I would see pictures of Donald Trump being held up in the streets in Hong Kong, like on the university campuses. I think Hong Kong University, I went on the campus and saw. I saw a painted picture of, like, Trump shaking hands with Xi because they felt that Trump was the one who could negotiate something positive for the protesters against Xi. And it really, in a way, it saddened me because I felt that they were placing their hopes in the wrong place. Trump, as we know, is not a champion of liberal democracy or of human rights. He's never spoken, as far as I can tell, he's never spoken about any human rights cause in recent memory. As we know, he embraces autocrats. He likes autocrats. He speaks glowingly of Xi, even though he sees China as a predatory trade partner of the U.S. He talks about Xi as a strong person, as a smart person, as a close friend, even though they have no personal relationship at all. And and it's the same with Putin. He talks about Putin in the same terms, and he and Putin have no relationship. And he loves Kim, of course. We've seen that play out. And so it sort of saddened me when they were looking to the U.S. as this beacon. And of course, that act did pass, and the U.S. did take some measures, but nothing happened. Like, it didn't change the course of history in Hong Kong. I mean, it's a very tough question you pose. I think we're just at the start of the second Trump administration. It's hard to see how the world evolves in the coming years. But I do think that we look to countries that are not as big as the U.S., but where democracy has taken root in very strong ways as potential beacons. And I think one thing that I think about is South Korea, for instance, because I think in the winter when we saw the president of South Korea try to declare martial law there, the reaction was instant. People took to the streets. The lawmakers from both parties, the incumbent party and the opposition party, banded together to oppose the president. His own party stepped up against him, and I think it sort of saved the political system in Korea. And so there, and I think as long as other countries are taking these actions, the citizens as well as officials on some level are taking these actions, then there are these models for people around the world.
Louisa, what are your thoughts?
I mean, I think after the 29 protests, the crackdown on Hong Kong has been so extreme and continuing. And I think the problem is that we don't see it. It's not tanks rolling through the streets. It's done through legislative means, round after round of national security legislation, which is so broad and so vague. And I think it's, you know, we've seen since then the disillusion, really, of Hong Kong, the civil society falling apart, political parties, trade unions, newspapers shutting down, the disappearance of archives, even government archives. The ombudsman's report was just removed online this week. And then the mass exodus of Hong Kongers. We've seen hundreds of thousands of Hong Kongers leave. And I think that's a sign that Hong Kongers realize there is no one they can look to except themselves. We're seeing, you know, it's great that Australia has accepted and taken in Hong Kongers and the UK too, but possibly with too many conditions and difficulties. But we are seeing these small communities in exile which are rebuilding and entering politics in those countries as well. So I think, you know, it's very much a question of almost the Hong Kong that exists in Hong Kong is now, you know, there are many people living there that are mainlanders. Even during the protest, people talked about this metaphor of keeping the goldfish bowl but changing the fish. And I think what we've seen is those Hong Kong migrants have gone elsewhere and they're, you know, setting up new shops and businesses, and I think there's many in Sydney. And just as a very quick anecdote, I actually went to an art exhibition by a Sydney-based Hong Kong artist called Natalie Trin Yau To, and her artwork, it was so interesting. It was all about salt farming and that history of rebellion. And what she did, I'm not joking, is she actually harvested her own salt from her sweat. And then showed this sort of salt sweat, really speaking to that history of rebellion and resistance and self-determination. And I just thought that was really interesting that we're seeing these conversations happen even outside.
Now, Linda, we are down to our last couple of minutes for your special question, which is for extra points. Reading your book about the Cultural Revolution in China and looking at Donald Trump's revolution in America, is Donald Trump conducting, is there an American cultural revolution underway in America today?
I think there is. And I think that there's a lot of serious aspects to this question. I first thought about it when Elon Musk called on people on X to denounce and raise the names of public servants who should be fired. It immediately made me think of the concept of mass dictatorship, which was Mao's idea that the masses could be used to exercise dictatorship over each other. And then I began to look out for other parallels because I was just, you know, finishing up the book and stuff. And I was like, oh my God. Anyway, there are so many. I'm just going to name two more. One is the personality cult, I think, is genuine with Trump in a way it isn't quite with Xi. Sorry, Xi. But, you know, you see in the Cultural Revolution, people just covering themselves with Mao badges. And somebody sent me a meme the other day of this young guy at a MAGA rally, and he had a MAGA hat, of course, and he had this T-shirt that was tons of different pictures of Donald Trump's face. And then the meme, of course, said, how to remain a virgin your whole life. But, but the other thing, I think, which brings us to a very serious aspect of this, is Mao once said, he said this to Edgar Snow, and Edgar Snow didn't get that this was a Chinese pun. He said, I feel like a monk with an umbrella. Now, in Chinese, there's a lot of very complicated or very clever puns, and this one referred to somebody with no hair and no sky, wu fa wu tian, which means lawless. It means nothing can, you know, control you, nothing can limit you. I can do whatever I want. Of course, Edgar Snow, sweet Edgar Snow, goes back to the United States and he writes this, or he doesn't go back to the States because he's living in exile, but he writes an article, I think for Life magazine, and he describes this encounter with Mao and he says, and he feels like a solitary monk alone in the rain or something. No, no. But that, if you think about Donald Trump saying that he could shoot someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue and get away with it, his calls on people to attack journalists, he boasted that apparently, through a lawyer or something, I can't remember now exactly, but he said that he could probably have political rivals assassinated. You know, there is that similarity which puts America in danger in a way that I think people who understand it's an emergency understand it's an emergency, but it certainly is that.
I'd love to go on. We are over time, so we're going to have to finish there. I think you'd all agree, absolutely fascinating.
Recorded live at the 2025 Sydney Writers' Festival, China, Past, Present, Future. You heard from Linda Javen, author of Bombard the Headquarters, China's Cultural Revolution, Associate Professor Louisa Lim, who is co-host of the Little Red podcast, and author of Indelible City, Dispossession and Defiance in Hong Kong, and journalist Edward Wong, the author of At the Edge of Empire, A Family's Reckoning with China. Peter Harcher is the political and international editor of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. He was asking the questions. I'm your host, Natasha Mitchell. Until later.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.